Welcome, and thank you for tuning into this week's episode of Maryland's Most Notorious Murders, where the most gruesome, the most horrific, the most high-profile homicide cases in Maryland, they are discussed, they are examined, and they are profiled. Now, according to LegalDictionary.com, the word parricide is defined as the murder of a close relative. It could be like your siblings, like a brother or sister, or the victim could be like your aunt, your uncle, cousin, or any other close relative. Now, you would think that the murder of a parent would automatically warrant like a sentence of like life or life without parole, or at least life with the possibility of parole, but apparently it don't. And mostly all of the murderers in this season have either already been released, they have served their time, they have moved on. And for, you know, those listeners who are truly familiar with, you know, me and my story, I'm gonna say it again. No, I will not be profiling or discussing the murder of my father, because that case has already been profiled for TV One several times, and that's pretty much kind of like old news now, and you can already check all of that out on my payback episode, which was on TV One, my Justice by Any Means episode, which is on TV One also, or you can click on my podcast episode entitled Why I Do What I Do. Anyway, but for this season, season 8, the focus or topic of discussion will be killers who, for whatever reason, have murdered their mother or their father or their grandparents. Basically, killers who have been accused and convicted of murdering a parent or a grandparent. So for this episode, season 8, and this particular episode, the killers that I am going to profile are 17-year-old Sarah Elizabeth Citroni and 19-year-old Jason Aaron DeLong. And like I have done in every single episode that has been featured on this podcast, a portion will be dedicated to an unsolved homicide that needs special attention, or it needs to be reopened or something, because basically not a lot, if anything, is being done anymore. And the unsolved murder that I'm going to profile for this episode is the shooting murder of 35-year-old Rodney Bryan. Whew. Now, although this whole podcast is about high-profile murder cases that occurring in this lovely state of Maryland, and absolutely no way whatsoever does this podcast condone or encourages anyone to go out and commit the act of murder. I'm gonna put this disclaimer out here right now. In no way am I playing sort of an advocate to the act of murder in no type of way, shape, or form. Like, in no way am I trying to be like, okay, well, you should go out and kill somebody, you know, blah, blah, blah. And y'all gonna hate me for this one and for this particular episode, because with all of that emphasis, you know, all the emphasis that I give to the victims of homicide, most of the victims that are profiled here on this podcast, they were like true victims. I say that to mean like nobody deserves to be killed. Nobody deserves to have their life taken away by somebody else. And I don't think I've ever profiled a case on here where the victim, quote unquote, deserved what happened to them. But for some cases and some victims, you choose your own fate. Like, how can you expect any other outcome than somebody taking your life? I mean, it sounds weird, but let me explain this next case. This next case starts off like this. You know, you got two troubled teenagers. At first, Sarah Elizabeth Citroni, She was just a normal teenager growing up in Reisterstown, Maryland. She was the second oldest out of five of her siblings. She had a normal life. She had friends. She got good grades. She had an active social life. She had no behavior problems at home or at school. Sarah was active in sports. She wasn't a problem child. She wasn't a problem teen. None of that. Then tragedy struck the family when Sarah's mother died of pancreatic cancer. Sarah was only 15 years old when she lost her mother, and her mother was everything to her, like most mothers are to their own teenage daughters at this age, you know, specifically when they are impressionable and everything. I mean, whether they want to admit it or not, most teenage daughters at this age are close to their mothers. The death of her mother completely destroyed Sarah, and she just could not cope with it. So, like most depressed teens, Sarah started acting out. She started skipping school. She started being disrespectful. Her grades started slipping. Sarah lost all interest in sports or any other activities that used to bring her any kind of joy. To top all of this off, Sarah started hanging out with the wrong crowd and experimenting a little bit with drugs. In just 2 short years, Sarah went from an average student involved with an active social life to basically a teenage punk rocker who wore all black and was barely recognizable, you know, barely making it through school at Franklin High School, which is my alma mater. Anyway, Sarah stayed angry all the time. She stayed depressed. She wouldn't listen to her father, who was left to raise 5 kids all on his own. And Sarah kept running away from home. She kept being rebellious, you know, dipping and dabbing in the drugs, mingling with the wrong crowd, driving her family crazy, isolating herself from her family and former friends, you know, how teenagers sometimes do. During Sarah's senior year at Franklin High School, which was supposed to be a happy and joyous time, instead, Sarah struggled academically and emotionally. Towards the end of the school year, Franklin High School gave Sarah a feeble, small chance to graduate because Sarah had failed almost half her classes. Sarah did show a small bit of promise when she studied hard enough to come within just 1 point. Seriously, just 1 point of what was required for her to pass a geometry test in order for her to graduate and walk across that stage. And when she couldn't graduate because of one silly little retarded little point, that sank Sarah into an even bigger pit of depression and gloom. Now, according to articles in the Baltimore Sun, when the assistant principal at Franklin High School heard this news about Sarah not graduating, she knew that Sarah not being able to graduate and walk across that stage would push Sarah over the edge, and she went to Sarah's geometry teacher herself and asked the teacher if Sarah could take the test again after Sarah studied just a little bit more. But true to Franklin's high school's teacher's nature, their teachers was like this for real, honestly. This particular teacher was like, nope. I don't care what she going through at home. I don't care nothing about her mother dying. I don't care about none of that. Nope. No retakes. I mean, I swear, this is the shit that takes me back to this school. I think I was a senior at Franklin High School, Reisterstown, Maryland. I struggled with Social Studies 10, and I could barely pass that class. Social Studies it's not my thing. I mean, plus, I was like 5 months pregnant at 17 years old, which I had to hide from the school because that was back in the 90s. I mean, but that's a whole other story. The point is, I barely graduated, and I would have been absolutely floored if I wouldn't have been able to graduate because of 1 point on a geometry test. A subject I can almost guarantee I'm not going to need no time soon. To me, that's cruel and unusual punishment in my book. Franklin's assistant principal at the time, she gave a statement to the Baltimore Sun saying, in her words, she said, I asked the teacher if she can retake the exam after studying the material, like, or a little bit more, but the teacher wouldn't. I knew this was a blow to this child, and I knew it was a blow she could not stand. The lack of graduating was something I felt she would not be able to deal with successfully. And because Sarah didn't graduate, there was no other plans. There was, like, no plans for college, nothing planned for, like, her future. And, you know, when they say about your idle time, a month after school ended, 17-year-old Sarah met 19-year-old Jason Aaron DeLong at Cranberry Mall in Westminster. Now, Jason's upbringing was nothing like Sarah's upbringing. Jason's childhood was 10 times worse. Born in Jupiter, Florida, as a child, Jason had been basically shuttled back and forth from Jupiter, Florida, where his father lived, to Maryland, where his mother lived, with both of Jason's parents constantly fighting over custody of him. Eventually, Jason ended up in the care and custody of his mother, who reportedly neglected Jason and physically, emotionally, and sexually abused him over a number of years. Jason grew up very disturbed, very angry, very depressed, very confused. As a student at Francis Scott Key High School, Jason got his first criminal charge when he lit some firecrackers under a table in the school cafeteria. The school ain't play that type of shit, especially since everybody thought that the firecrackers were gunshots. Kids be thinking pranks like that shit is funny, but it's not. Seriously, I mean, especially now in this day and age, you lighting firecrackers under the desk in a cafeteria? And the school eventually charged Jason. They actually pressed charges against him for that. They filed charges. Jason was arrested and charged with possession of illegal fireworks, discharging fireworks, reckless endangerment, and disturbing the peace. As a juvenile, Jason ended up getting probation before judgment for that charge. And that was really the only charge that he had on his record. And Jason had been living with his mother in Maryland for about a year before he met Sarah at the Cranberry Mall. And maybe it was because they both had sob stories about their lives. Maybe because they both had depression issues, anger and mood issues, and, you know, that type of mental connection, that they felt that the world was against them and that nobody loved them. And when you put all that together, it was an instant attraction that turned out to be a deadly match made heading straight to hell. Jason and Sarah confided in each other about their dismal lives, and quickly they developed a relationship which rapidly turned into like a boyfriend-girlfriend type of situation. Jason told Sarah all about the physical and sexual abuse that he had went through at the hands of his mother, and it made Sarah physically sick. According to articles in the Baltimore Sun, Sarah started encouraging Jason to take his mother out of the picture completely, even calling him a chicken because Jason had hesitated. Sarah couldn't understand how a mother could force her son, her teenage son, to have sex with her. The thought of it made her sick, and they both came to the conclusion that Jason's mother should not be able to live anymore. Not among regular people, you know, and that she should be eliminated altogether. Together, they decided that because Jason's mother was such a sick, demented, and trifling person, that they were going to destroy her. So after they spent the night at a neighbor's house, on the morning of July 29th, 1993, Sarah and Jason went to Jason's mother's apartment in the 900 block of Charles Street in the Bishop's Garth apartment complex in Westminster. 39-year-old Catherine Brace Farah and Jason's stepfather, 35-year-old George William Wall, were both at home in the apartment that morning. When Catherine asked Jason for a cup of coffee, he went into the kitchen to make it. And when Jason gave his mother the cup of coffee and she took a sip, Jason made his move and plunged a hunting knife into the side of his mother's neck. Then he started stabbing her viciously in her back, head, all over. While Jason was taking care of business in the kitchen with his mother, Sarah was in another room of the apartment stabbing Jason's stepfather, George, with a folding knife, cutting and slicing the man so ferociously that she accidentally cut her own fingers several times in the process because the knife kept slipping. It's a folding knife. You know, when Jason had a hard time holding, when Sarah had a hard time holding down George, she yelled to Jason for help. Jason heard Sarah's pleas for help, and he stopped stabbing his mother for a minute and started helping Sarah to stab George. Slashed and cut more than 40 times, after Jason and Sarah killed George, they went back into the kitchen to make sure that his mother was dead. For good measure, they both started stabbing Catherine some more. With more than 80 stab wounds to her body, anybody who investigated this homicide could clearly see that this was one that was personal. This was the first homicide that Westminster had experienced in 7 years. After this whole bloody massacre was over, both Sarah and Jason ran out of the apartment, hopped in Catherine's 1980 Chevrolet Chevette, and headed onto Interstate 95 to go straight to Florida. But on the way there, they made a quick pit stop and picked up a friend of theirs, a 14-year-old boy who had ran away from his home in Reisterstown, Maryland. 3 days after the murders, the neighbors in the apartment complex reported to the police that there was like a foul odor coming from George and Catherine's apartment. And when the police went inside to investigate further, that's when they found their bodies. Pronounced dead at the scene, George had worked at the McDonald's in Westminster, and about 45 people showed their condolences at his funeral. Jason's mother, Catherine, had worked as a nurse before she was brutally killed by her son. The neighbors had told the police that they had seen Jason speed off in his mother's car 3 days earlier and that he had what appeared to be blood on his pants leg. After hearing this, the detectives had composite sketches of both Sarah and Jason drawn up, and they started circulating the pictures, like, to the press and to, like, various members of law enforcement agencies. Meanwhile, Jason and Sarah was on the run, and they made it all the way to Florida. Once they arrived in Florida, they decided to ditch the car, and they left it with the 14-year-old kid runaway who came with them from Reisterstown. That kid ended up crashing the car in a field in St. Augustine, Florida, and he was arrested by Florida police shortly after crashing the car. When Florida police quickly realized that that kid had been driving a vehicle that not only had been reported stolen and that the owner of the vehicle had been killed, the cops asked the kid if anybody else had been with them and where he had gotten the car from. That kid wasted no time and told the police that he had dropped off Sarah and Jason at a shopping center just hours earlier. Florida police raced to look for Sarah and Jason, and on Wednesday, August the 5th, 1993, around 4:15 a.m., this in the wee hours of the morning, members of the Jupiter, Florida Police Department, they saw the couple on the road trying to hitchhike the remaining 220 miles to Jason's hometown of Jupiter, Florida, where Jason was trying to reunite with his father. After both Sarah and Jason were arrested and taken to the Palm County Beach jail, Florida put their asses on a plane and they were shipped right back to Maryland, where they were officially charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder as well as conspiracy to commit murder. Held without bail and charged as adults, neither Sarah or Jason sugarcoated what they had done. Jason basically told the detectives that, you know, yeah, he did what he did because basically he said he snapped all because of the years of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse that he had received from his mother. He was like, Jason's stepfather, George, was just basically in the wrong place at the wrong time. Sarah also told the detectives that she participated in the murders because although she had only known Jason for about, you know, 2 weeks or so, that she couldn't stand what she was hearing about Jason's mother. And she felt that it was her duty. Like, she felt that, you know, she deserved to die. In fact, she told the detectives that stabbing that woman gave her great pleasure because of the way that she had treated her son. At first, Jason pled guilty by reason of insanity, and Jason was found not criminally responsible for the actual murders, but he was found guilty for the conspiracy to commit murder of his mother and stepfather. Before Jason was sentenced, the judge made a comment stating, "I'm not convinced that Jason, if turned loose from Clifton T. Perkins, would not kill again, and that it would not be a woman and not have sexual overturns." Jason was also allowed to speak at his sentencing hearing, and he told the court in his words, "I'm very sorry for what happened. I didn't mean for this to happen. I don't know why it is taking so long to get help. All I've ever wanted is to get help. I've wanted to do this for a long time. I'm glad Sarah finally got me over the hump." Jason got a life sentence that day, but he did manage to receive treatment for mental illness at Clifton T. Perkins before he was eventually transferred to a more regular prison institution. Sarah, on the other hand, although she was going through some issues because of the sudden death of her mother and whatnot, Sarah's defense was, and I mean, you gotta respect it, she was triggered by what Jason had been telling her about his mother, what she had been doing to him all, you know, throughout most of his life, especially the sex abuse, and she stuck to her defense. But Sarah did eventually plead guilty to 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. At Sarah's sentencing hearing, she told the court that she relives the grisly murders every single day. Sarah was also allowed to make a statement, and in her words, she told the court, "This is something I can't forgive myself for. Day in and day out, I am constantly reminded of what I have done. I can't believe it happened." The judge had words of his own when he said, in his words, "These theories about why you did this are interesting, but they're academic. No one but you, Sarah, knows why you committed these horrific deeds. 2 bodies lie in premature graves as a result of your rage. That's fact, not theory." So basically he was saying that he ain't, not necessarily he didn't believe it, but she can't prove it. Anyway, then the judge sentenced Sarah to 2 consecutive life terms. But check it. Like I said in the beginning of this podcast, life don't necessarily mean life in this state. Not a life sentence anyway. Especially if a parent is killed on the basis of you know, any type of abuse. Physical abuse, sexual abuse, any type of defense like that. And in September of 2022, Sarah was released on the basis of the Juvenile Restoration Act. Now, the Juvenile Restoration Act is like a new law that just came into play in, like, I think it was in this state, like 2021, where if you were a minor under 18 when you committed your crime, and you were a juvenile, like, but they tried you, but the state tried you as an adult, and you received a life sentence, then you can have a judge reconsider your original life sentence. after you've already been served like at least 20 years, after you've already been locked up at least 20 years, that much time in your sentence, you can actually apply for release. Plus, the Juvenile Restoration Act completely disbarred, they completely done away with where if you are a juvenile and you commit a crime, even if it's murder, where you can be sentenced to life without parole. So after a judge took a look at Sarah's case and he saw that Sarah had completely changed her life while she was locked up, she became a better person, completely changed her life around, did a 360. Sarah was eventually released and she walked out of prison a free woman after she had completely changed her life for the better. And she had been locked up, I believe, like 29 years. Now, Jason, he still remains in prison to this day. Now, the reason why this made, of course, this case made one of the most notorious parasite cases in Maryland is because I profiled this case on Killer Kids. And this was the very first time that I had profiled a homicide case, at least on that was televised anyway. It was the first time I was on video and it was filmed. How can this not be one of Maryland's most notorious? And not even just because of that, but because of the brutality of it. I mean, ugh. I mean, I didn't know his mother, but if she did that, listen, I mean, sexual abuse, that from a mother, like a son, I can't even imagine the mental damage that would cause. It's like the judge said, I mean, he will probably automatically hate women probably the rest of his life. He don't know if he can't guarantee that he would not commit a crime like that again, and especially not against like another female. He probably hate women now. Like his mother did that to him. And do I believe it? Who would lie about that? That's a big lie. That's a big one. I mean, I've never heard that. Do I think that Sarah deserved to be free? Honestly, yeah. To be honest, after 29 years, she was locked up as a teenager. I believe she served her time. You know, she did what she had to do. I mean, I think Jason, I hate to say it, but I think he's probably damaged for life. I mean, he, like I said, he probably hates women. That's probably why he's not out. His mother ruined him. I can't even imagine. I mean, and as far as the stepfather, wrong place at the wrong time. But why would you want to be with somebody like that who's doing that to their son? So, yeah. Of course, this made the list for, you know, one of Maryland's most notorious parasite cases. Moving right on to this episode's unsolved homicide. And just like in every episode that has been on this podcast, although a lot of attention and a lot of focus is placed on homicide cases where they may have received a lot of press, a lot of attention, a lot of media coverage, this podcast also shines a light on the many homicide cases that we see in the state that do not receive a lot of attention. They don't receive a lot of press, if any attention at all. These type of murders are so common in this state, it's not a lot of time to focus on just one. Honestly, sometimes when a person gets murdered in this lovely state of Maryland, you literally don't hear nothing else about it other than just like the initial report, because by the time they finish with the initial report, somebody else then got killed. And the number of homicides that are unsolved in this state is completely staggering. It's unbelievably, really. It's obvious that homicide detectives, they can't do it all like what you might see on the first 48, you know, or forensic files or something like that. In Maryland, it's not like that. Homicide detectives are often overworked, underpaid, understressed, and flat out outnumbered, and basically kept busy all the time. But you may wonder what happens to the type of cases where nobody is talking about, like, the cases that have been completely buried and nobody's talking about them at all. What happens when there are absolutely no clues, no evidence, no witnesses whatsoever? Or what happens to those type of cases where, because of the victim's past or, you know, the victim's lifestyle, where it seems like, it just kind of seems like the detectives are not really doing too much. They're not really trying to solve it or investigate the case because the victim, quote unquote, had it coming. I mean, what happens to those type of homicide cases? Did the killer or killers simply just, like, get away with murder? It just seems like literally nothing is done with these forgotten homicide cases, not because nobody cares anymore, but because the public simply forgot all about it, because we've been bombarded by new homicides. It's like we have been almost immune to homicides in this state. Well, on this podcast, although I do talk about cases where the murder did receive a lot of attention and notoriety, on the flip side, a focus is also on homicide cases that did not receive the amount of attention that they deserve. And with that being said, this episode's unsolved homicide is the shooting murder of 35-year-old Rodney Bryan. Cockeysville, Maryland, December 19th, 1999, in an unusually quiet area of North Baltimore County, Baltimore County Police showed up to an apartment in the 600 block of Clover Crest Road because earlier they had received a report of someone screaming and then a loud bang. The police were able to get into the apartment, and when they did, they found the body of 35-year-old Rodney Bryan. Pronounced dead at the scene, Rodney had been shot several times in his upper body. As of today, Baltimore County detectives have no leads, no clues, and they need your help. So imagine if this was your family and you wanted, you know, answers. So if you have any information that can lead to an arrest or conviction in this 24-year-old homicide, please call Baltimore County Detectives at 410-307-2020 or 1-866-7-LOCKUP or 410-887-3943. Or you can text your tip to CRIMES, that's C-R-I-M-E-S, or on your numeric keypad, that's 274-637. Once again, those numbers are Baltimore County Detectives at 410-307-2020 or Metro Crime Stoppers at 1-866-7-LOCKUP. Or 410-887-3943. Or you can text your tip to CRIMES, that's C-R-I-M-E-S, on your numeric keypad, 274-637. There is a $2,000 reward for any information leading to an arrest or conviction in this unsolved homicide. Thank you for tuning in this week. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast via Spotify for updates on future spine-tingling, hair-raising, eye-popping episodes. And for paid subscribers, be sure to check out the real, the raw, the uncensored version of why I decided to start a true crime podcast. A lot of people think I just woke up one day and then out of nowhere I just had a dream and then there's a podcast. But nope. That's not even half of the truth. There is a real therapy-based message to this true crime world of gore and mayhem and guts and blood. And if you click on the episode entitled Why I Do What I Do, you'll understand more about why I'm so weird, why I'm always into, you know, crime and murders and stuff like that. It's you know, why I'm so fascinated with true crime. I also want my listeners to know that very, very soon, I would say probably before the beginning of season 9, that the documentary version, the film version of this podcast episode, though number one, the very first episode of this podcast, which was based on accused child murderers, Adon Canella and Policarpio Espinoza, will be released very, very soon. I must warn y'all, I'm not even going to lie, it is very graphic, which is why I'm having a hard time getting clearance for it now. But I'm not editing my stuff. I don't censor what I put out there, and there's a reason why it's that way. So anyway, when the documentary, which was produced by Savage Life Productions and filmed on location in Baltimore City, will be available for download, I will definitely keep you posted as to where you can download it or where you can receive it via email or whatever. And while you're at it, stop on over to the new website, Maryland's Most Notorious Murders.com, and Maryland is spelled MDS, where you can access all episodes of this podcast and check out the different seasons that we have focused on throughout the episodes, like relationship murders, teen killers, you know, stuff like that. You can also find links to all of my true crime books that are loosely related to this podcast, entitled Maryland's Most Notorious Murders, 1990 through 2008, Maryland's Unsolved Homicides, Volume 1, and my local bestsellers, Until I Get Caught, The True Story of a Serial Rapist in Baltimore, which is a book that every woman should read. I mean, it'll blow you away. They label that as contraband in the prisons. And anyway, also my book, Junkie, A True Baltimore Story. You can also check me out on season 1 of Payback, which airs for the TV1 network. You can check me out on the Oxygen Network for Black Widow Murders, where I profiled Maryland's female serial killer, Josephine Gray. Or you can check me out on TV1's Justice by Any Means, TV1's Fatal Attraction, where I profiled the North Carolina child murderer, Peter Moses. Or you can also find me hosting Killer Kids for the LMN Network, where I profiled teen killers Sarah Citroni and Jason DeLong, who was also profiled for this episode's podcast. Once the season 1 documentary is available for download, you'll also be able to find the links here at Maryland's Most Notorious Murders.com. Please be sure to tune in next week, where another gruesome, another high profile, another outrageous homicide occurring in Maryland will be profiled, it will be examined, and it will be discussed on Maryland's Most Notorious Murders. This has been a Savage Life production.